Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour. I want to thank the lovely people at Cooker who sponsor the podcast. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Mine does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling water too. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. You won't be disappointed if you get one. I promise you that. I absolutely love mine. Today's Hour conversation is 15 questions with Daniel Mays. He's an actor that I've always wanted to get on this podcast. His talent, I think, is truly immense. Every time I see him in something, he blows me away. He graduated from RADA in 2000. Mike Leigh cast him in both All or Nothing and Vera Drake. Mays has said that working with Leigh was decisive in making him the kind of actor he wanted to be. Daniel's been in so many things, so many great things. Recently, he's been in movies such as 1917 and Fisherman's Friends. Recent TV shows such as Dez, which was all about Dennis Nielsen, the serial killer. White Lines, which was on Netflix, and Code 404, which was on Sky. So certainly does the rounds in the world of TV. They all want him. Let's meet him. He's Daniel Mays. Hey, Daniel, how are you?
Very good, Tim. How's it going, mate?
Yeah, in the middle of the pandemic, it's all right. Just juggling along. You're still managing to do some work, though, aren't you?
I have worked. I've shot the second series of both Code 404 and Temple. So that's been keeping me very busy. It's been great to have something to focus on, you know. I feel blessed. So many of my actor mates have just, you know, they're not doing anything. And so I'm counting my lucky stars. I've been able to go back. I mean, it's blown my mind how much effort and work's gone into it from a production side of things. You know, the logistics, the middle of Temple, it was full down lockdown. So it was, you know, they lost locations. I mean, the logistics that go into it, it's been very tricky. For the producers and all those types of people. But we managed to get through, you know, they looked after us, COVID tests left, right and center. And, you know, once they say action, Tim, you've just got to do your job again. It's just all of the stuff around it, getting up to that point, which has been a challenge for everyone.
It's been great, though, hasn't it? Because I obviously on my show, I interview a lot of actors. And to begin with, the first few months, it was obviously everyone was just saying, look, there's going to be no work. No one's going to do anything. And slowly but surely, they've managed to get productions back on the soaps. They're having to do this really strange social distancing thing, you know, where they're even using their own boyfriends or husbands to come in for love scenes and put them in wigs because they're not allowed to.
I don't think my wife would be up for that. That is just bizarre, isn't it? Yeah, God, yeah. Wow.
All right, let's go on with these questions. It's as you know, it's a mechanism for having a good chat, and we'll find out some more stuff about you. And I love you, and I love your work, and you've always been such a great guest on Sunday Brunch. So hopefully, we'll get some good answers out of these. What's one piece of advice you would like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
I seem to those that come and go in my life. I mean, the overriding thing. I guess was instilled in me from my parents was that you only get out of life what you put in. And it's about, you know, enjoying everything and expecting nothing as such. I mean, that's all to do with, I guess, my working class background, that sort of work ethic that my parents both had. My dad's an electrician. He's still an electrician, you know, grafting in his white van, pulling cables through walls and all that sort of stuff. So, but I think there's always merit in life to participate in as many things as possible. I mean, I can hear my agent in my ears going, Danny, turn work down. You know, you don't have to take that job. You can maybe sit it out. But I always feel that I get very idle very quickly. And I think it's good to keep busy. Because you never know in life what opportunities will spring from that thing that you're doing. So it's, you know, you've got to put the work in.
It's the biggest problem I've had, Danny, when I've been, when I first started getting success doing Soccer AM and stuff, I was getting offered these jobs. And I basically thought, I so don't want this to end. I took everything.
Yeah.
And at one stage, I was doing radio show. I was producing, presenting, writing Soccer AM. I was doing columns. I was exhausted. And I had the kids as well. And I was just... And eventually I had to sort of say, I can't do it all. It's just, it was
mad. Did you get to a point where it was just burnout, Tim?
I was so burned. I burnt myself out. I've burnt myself out a few times in my life, you know, and it's, but it's you, when you find something you love, like we do, it's so hard to think that it could go away. So you just take everything, because every day of working was a privilege and a pleasure. So I didn't hate any of it. It just burnt you out because you don't have enough time. Yeah.
Yeah. I've always kind of got that actor sensibility where they tap you on the shoulder and go, come in, Mr. Mays, your time is up. Yeah. You've had a really successful run of things, but now it's time to pass the baton over. But I think it's good to have that mentality though, isn't it? It keeps you fresh, keeps you on your toes, keeps you creative, and just that sort of hunger that you have to have in both our jobs.
I said in the intro that you had said that after working with Mike Lee, you said that working with Lee was decisive in making you the kind of actor that you wanted to be. I assume by that you actually mean a lot of hard work into every role you do and full commitment.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, I did two films with Mike. I mean, the first film was a year out of drama school. So, and, you know, just to get the opportunity to do back-to-back films with Mike so early on, it was just like an education all in itself. And it's, you know, it's just hard graft. He is, the center of his world is the character and finding the truth for that character and putting the work in and leaving no stone unturned into sort of delivering a sort of layered and believable performance. And I think, I mean, I that sort of industrious quality that he naturally has as a director, I mean, that has fueled and influenced the work that I've done since working with him, without a doubt.
And before I move on to the next question, which might have relevance to that, you said your dad was an electrician. How did you become an actor?
Well, I'm one of four boys. So I got two older brothers, one younger. We were all kind of sports mad. It was either tennis, football, cricket, golf. My dad was a player manager of Kelvedon Hatch in Essex. So, but my two older brothers were exceptionally good at sport, and I probably wasn't as good as them two. And I just found that I needed to find something else to sort of break the mold or to be noticed. It's a classic middle child syndrome, isn't it, Tim? It's that thing of going, how can I be noticed? I mean, I was always jumping around doing impressions. I was always the sort of clown in the class, you know, making people laugh. And that sort of led on to go into, and then, you know, my mum took me to see Michael Jackson in the Bad Tour 1988, which was a total light bulb moment. So my party piece became my Michael Jackson routine. So every disco, my mate, you know, the song would come on, they'd do a circle and I'd do my Michael Jackson. That led to a local dance school, that led to Italia Conti, and then eventually I went to RADA. So I've always been an extrovert, so to speak. Yeah,
I've seen your Michael Jackson routine online. You're very good. Very, very good. Love it. All right. Let's get on to the next question. What's been the best moment of your career?
Oh, it's a tough one, that. I've had so many amazing experiences. Of late, it's been particularly good. I think of Dez, which was on, or White Lines and stuff like that. They were great jobs. Mrs. Big springs to mind, Ashes to Ashes. But I don't know. I think I did Line of Duty. When was it now? Maybe about 5 years ago now, which was a real highlight, in my career, because, you know, I had to go in and audition for it. I was a big fan of the first two series, but it wasn't an offer by any stretch of the imagination. So I had to learn as much of that interrogation scene as possible and go in and try and get the part. Luckily enough, it came my way. But it was one of those parts, Tim, that, you know, as soon as you read it, you were like, wow, this is, the writing was out of this world. The character was layered. It was a real gift. And as soon as certain parts come along, when you read the script, you can instantly visualize it. You know, I could imagine myself playing it. I got it. It was a wonderful experience making it, a lot of hard work. And then, you know, you give it over to the audience and the reaction was phenomenal. You know, it was I ended up getting a BAFTA nom for it, and the show itself took on a whole different level. It then went to BBC One, and from a cult following, it's become this mainstream juggernaut, really. And I feel very blessed to be one of those lead protagonists. I know I only lasted one episode, but it was to be in there with Tandy Newton and Lenny James and Keely Hawes, and I feel very privileged to have been part of that show.
Do you prefer doing the movies or the TV series? Or do you care?
I don't really care now, Tim. I think TV, I mean, look, getting a middle of the road budget-wise British movie is very difficult. I mean, anything's difficult in a pandemic that we're going through, but that art form seems to be, you know, British independent film is still there, but it's very difficult to get those films made. TV seems to be the place where it will give you longevity. It will give you the better parts, for me personally anyway. But then, you know, I've ended up, you know, being a small cog in a big wheel in the likes of Star Wars or Tintin. So those experiences are, I mean, I remember doing Pearl Harbor was my second job out of drama school. I did EastEnders. No. And then I did Pearl Harbor. And I was like, it was just mind blowing because you literally had Michael Bay on the end of a crane screaming for a megaphone with Spitfires, and Ben Affleck's trailer was like, he had a gym on it. It was like a little village. And I was like, wow, this is a completely different scale. Is the whole scale of it was just huge. So I don't mind doing those sort of big Hollywood things as well. You know, you've got to try it all, haven't you?
I remember you turning up in 1917. And I was like, yes, this film's got so much good acting talent. Every other scene, someone else came. What a great film that was. Just brilliant.
Yeah, phenomenal thing to do. I mean, that was a no-brainer. It was like Sam Mendes and all these, Benedict Cumberbatch and Andrew Scott were in it. So, but to act in that movie, they sort of dug a whole First World War trench system on Salisbury Plain. I mean, it was literally, and everywhere you look, there was like, you know, extras as far as the eye could see. But to get up close and personal and to be able to work with the likes of Sam Mendes was just an absolute gift. You know, what a director.
What's the worst moment of your career?
Struggling with this a bit. I had such an amazing time on White Lines, which we shot for Netflix. I'd never done a Netflix show before, Tim. So it was a new experience. And then from our point of view, from the actors' point of view, that show just popped in terms of it was number one in the UK chart for like over a month, and it went all across Europe number one. It was just the audience reaction to it was kind of mind-blowing. You know, it was such a hit. And we just all took it as read that we were going to get a second series. And for whatever reason, they never pushed the green button. And so that was a crushing disappointment, I think, personally for me, because I just thought it had great longevity, that show. It had a lot of legs left in it. The character was one of the most fun times I've ever had on a set. And I thought you could have just taken that show to a different place, but it wasn't to be. But maybe, you know, maybe it just exists as a brilliant, you know, single series and that's it. But that was it was a downer for me. I was sort of crushed for a while.
Yeah, because I suppose what you do with those TV series on Netflix, and Code 404 is another one, you get the ability to create a character, don't you, and develop it over many weeks. And so when you put that much work in, it must be hard when it goes. But do you like that idea that you can build a character over multiple weeks?
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is also, I mean, I'd never actually shot a second series of anything. I've always been in films or single dramas. I mean, I joined Ashes to Ashes in the third series, but, you know, because I've just shot the second seasons of Code 404 and Temple, I'd never done that. I'd never sort of come back to reinvestigate the character again. So, but it's a great opportunity for you to have a new lease of life with it. and to have a security that the audience like the character, they're on board with the show. And it's like, so where can we take it next? And with both those shows, they're bigger, they're bolder, and they're taking more risks. So, and I think, you know, something like White Lions, I mean, you could have taken that anywhere. So, but, you know, I can't complain. Look, I've been busy. Do you know what I mean? So,
Well,
that one wasn't to be, but there's lots of other things.
The next question, what does success mean to you?
Sometimes I think, Tim, success in my profession is just to kind of keep working. Do you know what I mean? I think if I think back, you know, when I left drama school 20 years ago, I left 20 years ago, and if I'd have looked at myself and said, look, you're going to be all right, Dan, you're going to work in the profession, and you're not going to be, you won't have to take on another job. You know, you'll be existing solely as an actor 20 years down the line. I'd have bit your hand off. Do you know what I mean? I think that it's such a precarious industry. There's so many ups and downs. It's so competitive. You've got to have your armor plated on, as my dad says, and roll with the punches. But the fact that I'm able to have a family, I've got two kids, and I can financially support them, and that to me is success. It's always very flattering, and I'm sort of blessed that when you do get stopped in the street by people, and it's always really lovely when someone comes up. I mean, I was out having a jog the other day, and there was an elderly gentleman who I'd never met who was just around the corner from my house, and as I had my music on, and he sort of waved me down. So I was in the middle of the run, and he was just going out on his like little walk, this elderly guy, and he just said, you know, I just wanted to stop you because I'd seen you in Des recently, and I've seen most of your work, and just thank you so much for giving me so much pleasure. When you get feedback like that from Joe Public, it's just lovely, because you think, you know, you are providing a service, you are entertaining people, particularly in this difficult time. I did have a bit of a wobble, you know, when we had that first lockdown, and we're all clapping the NHS workers, and they're the true heroes. And when I did eventually go back to work, I did have a sort of moment of crisis where I was like, how relevant is it what I do for a living? Like, I really questioned the importance of what my job was and where that place is placed within the world. And I think, you know, we do need to be entertained. We do need our mood to be lifted. And I think, you know, it's a great thing that we can provide that.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, what makes an actor good. Because I can't act. But the way I agree with the old fellow, the stuff you do is amazing. And it's such a nice thing to, every time you're in something, I always go, okay, right, here we go, acting masterclass, because you are. And that thing you did with that Des with Tennant and, who's the other guy?
Jason Watkins.
That's it. I mean, it was just incredible. The acting ability of the three of you was just, it was fantastic. And I really thoroughly enjoyed it. So yeah, you do offer a great service. And that was really successful, wasn't it, Des? You've got that going. You've got that, was that ITV, was it?
It was ITV, yeah.
You've got White Lines on Netflix. You've got Code 404 on Sky One. I mean, that's pretty successful. You're covering all the bases there.
Yeah, all the channels. I've got to get another one on the thing, and I've got to do Amazon or something like that. But yes, I can't. I mean, I'm very blessed over the last 2-3 years. It's been, I don't know, you know, you sort of stay in the game and hopefully, you know, you're consistent and you learn your lines and you don't bump into the furniture and you're nice to people and courteous. And it's always been a pattern of my work though, Tim, is that people have sort of wanted to come back and work with me again, directors or producers and things like that. It's never been, I mean, I've been self-taping for a lot and not getting things because I don't think that's how my career has panned out. It's not, you know, I mean, I still have to deal with that rejection. Every actor has to deal with it all the time. So, but I think my trajectory has been people going, do you know what? That role, that's a Danny Mays part. And so let's just go to him first. Mm. That's sort of been the sort of way it's panned out. Very rarely if I'm in a big sort of group of people or I'm self-taping or if it's, you know, I don't know if I necessarily stand out in the crowd like that. It's been a much more of a sort of slower, long, hard, but enjoyable slog for me, I think, you know.
Have you, the next question is, what other jobs did you do? Have you done any other jobs if you got the gig straight out of RADA?
No, I tell you what, though, when I mean, I've done odd jobs growing up as a kid. I mean, I've done loads of different, I've done waitering. I helped my mate Richard Aragon is a roofer. So I remember when I was at drama school and it was over a winter and I was struggling for money. And Richard's a mate of my older brother, Paul. And he went, come on, I'll come out. He's a roofer. He said, come on, I'll take you. I'll take you roofing. And we put this roof on in a property in Covent Garden. And there was me carrying up rolls of lead up the I was just like, Richard, I can't believe you do this like day in, day out. So that was quite tough. I've sanded down buses. That was another job I did. You know, when you've got to repaint the buses. So I used to sand those buses down.
Can I just ask you about roofing? I did, again, similar to you. My friend Mickey Late said, I'm doing a patio. Do you fancy giving me a hand? And I went, yeah, all right. And after day three, my body was shot. I just had nothing left in, just digging and a move. And I was like, Mickey, how do you do this every day? And then another job I did was I had to carry barriers, you know, like security barriers. My mates were John and Simon and that lot. They were like, come and do some barriers, Tim. So I went down to Brighton. I can't remember the name of the venue. And it was Manic Street Preachers gig. And we had to take the barriers up. And you're supposed to take
right.
About four or five at a time.
Yeah,
so I did that the first two times. And then I was like, I can only take one at a time. And they were like, Lovejoy, that's no good to us. You just stand here and put them together. At the end of the night, when they're divvying up all the cash, I went, I can't take any. I'm so sorry. I'm so embarrassed.
You didn't take your money.
No, because it was these things. They're like these guys who carry those barriers around. I mean, their arms are like.
It's hard graft, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
But, you know, puts hairs on your chest, doesn't it? all those things. I mean, I remember also I did when I left drama school, I never worked for 6 months. So it was like, it was a really worrying time where you go, you know, I can't get arrested here. And what do I do? I've put all my eggs in one basket. Mm. I do remember them working for, it was a commercial casting agent, Jane Collins in King's Cross. So I was operating, I was working the camera and just auditioning extras. And in the end, I just took over the castings. So I felt like I was in and around the acting profession, but not actually part of it yet. And that will change when I got EastEnders.
All right. What's the your most outstanding fashion moment? Could be good or bad.
I do remember buying maybe after I'd got a few acting jobs and some money in my pocket, I remember walking around the men's department in Selfridges with my mate Stuart. And I bought this green, it was like a green Mac designer coat, which was ridiculously expensive. I thought it looked fantastic, you know. I mean, it was about 700 and something, which at the time for me was a lot of money. I mean, it was, you know, quite a lot of money for me at the time. And then I thought I looked the bee's knees, and I remember putting it on, and I had a family get together in Essex, and I walked in, and there was my brothers and cousins and all that, and as I walked in, they all burst out laughing, said, "Daddy, what on earth are you wearing? You look like a peace activist." It was just this trench coat thing. I still have it upstairs because, I don't know, I've got sentimental value for me. I don't know, and I can't seem to get rid of it.
That's right, amazing. I was online shopping the other day because you can't buy any clothes at the moment. I haven't got any clothes for Sunday brunch. I haven't bought any for ages. And I thought knitwear. I haven't worn any knitwear on the show. It's Rascal. I bought like this huge cardigan, and I'm not sure I've got the balls to wear it. It hasn't arrived yet, but it's like an over. Do you remember Starsky and Hutch? That type of
oversized
cardigan.
It's got a pattern over it and everything.
Yeah, it's got a pattern a lot. So I don't know if I've got the balls.
Wear it on Sunday. You'll have to wear it on the weekend. Tim?
I don't have it this arrived yet, but when it arrives, I'll wear it. see how I get on. People will lose their shit if I wear it, because it's one of those ones I woke up next morning and went, did I buy that? Right. What do you do to keep fit, Danny?
I'm a big runner, so I've got really into it years ago now, and I think because I've been members of gyms and things like that in the past, and it just doesn't really work for me, and so more for my mental health and fitness, I'll go for a good run. Do you know what I mean? And I'll go out for a 4 or 5 mile run. That's not a problem. I try and get in 3 a week. I do go to a personal trainer sometimes. I've got a couple of guys, Brown, over in Muswell Hill. And then we can't do it at the moment, but sometimes I also, there's like a group on a Saturday morning with a group of guys around here that meet on Hampstead Heath. And we do a workout with Richie over there, which is like an hour's workout, which is really, we used to do it really early. It used to be like a, I think it was like a half seven meet or something like that. Because you do a good workout and then you've got your whole weekend in front of you. Mm. But running is great for me. Running is, I find not only the fitness benefit, but it just, you know, when you've got two kids and it's all a bit hectic, it just gives you that space just to have for yourself. You know, it's you can think things through. I get a lot of thinking done when I'm running.
Are you decent at sport? Because you said your dad was a player manager and your brothers were good.
Yeah, no, I was a decent footballer. I was captain of Loughton Boys, and I was I used to play sweeper at the back, which seems to be a football position that is just non-existent now.
Yeah,
no one plays sweeper.
Yeah,
which is odd. So it was that. I mean, I don't really play now. I don't mind a game of tennis. I mean, golf is the big thing I play now. I mean, we're all golf mad, me and my brothers and my dad, and I occasionally play in my dad's golf society, which is a great laugh. And again, you know, it's just a great opportunity to, you know, catch up with people you haven't seen, you know.
What do you play off? What's your handicap?
I'm like 18. I'm nothing special. Do you know what I mean? I haven't got that to play it as much as I'd like.
Yeah, you don't have enough time, do you? So when you played football, were you like, did you have a good, fantastic passing rate? Were you like Perlow sitting at the back, though? Or were you like when Hoddle moved to sweeper or Hullet?
Yeah. I was the Glenn Hoddle of Loughton Boys. I was always a good passer, you know. I think when you're surrounded by it, because my brothers were so good, you know, you just get involved in it, don't you? And I just never had any pace, Tim. I was shocking. Maybe that's why they put me sweeper, because I was always good at long distance running, sprinting and, you know, off the mark. I was never very good at all.
When you go for your runs, how far do you go then?
I can do like a 4 or 5 mile run. Do you know what Perfect. I mean? I can do that just like in an hour or so.
And I'm going to cut forward the questions, because you mentioned it earlier. You said you like running for your mental health. How is your mental health?
I like, because of what we're all going through, I'm having to try and keep energized, keep active, particularly obviously with this lockdown throughout the winter. It's that thing of forcing yourself out the door, putting on your woolly hat and just hitting the pavement. Do you know what I mean? And it's, I think all of our mental healths have taken a battering, haven't they, at this time? I think it's, I think I'm probably like most people. I have good days and bad days. I mean, there's sometimes you just think I'm effectively, we're all in locked up in prison with this thing. I think that the notion of not being able to see your loved ones in person, not going to the cinema or going to the theatre, these things that we all took for granted, the fact that they've now been taken away at this time is very hard mentally for us to take. What I do worry about is that it's like when someone is in prison, isn't it? They talk about you become institutionalized. They get used to that routine of life. And I think, you know, the thing that, although you miss these things, there's an acceptance in us that we're not going to have these things at the moment. And I don't like that shift that's gone on in my head. And that's what, you know, it's effectively become the norm. And that's what I really worry about, because I'm longing for it to go back to where it was.
You've just said something which has really blown me away, because that's how I've arrived. I've really struggled at the beginning, and I've arrived now. This is it. And you're right. Right. I've become institutionalizing the fact I'm all right staying at home now. And it's just,
yeah.
But I try and take one day at a time. What's interesting, though, is you're in your industry. Okay, you're doing some TV stuff, which is good. I think it's a bit harder to make a movie at the moment because of insurance and everything, which they're struggling with. But the theater world, I mean, it's absolutely. Oh. It's had such a torrid time. And also the cinemas, I mean, wow. Yeah. How are they going to all survive off the back of this?
I don't know. I mean, the thing with the theatre is, you know, I've done theatre has been a huge component in my career. And I haven't done a play for 5 years, but certainly I did loads of plays at the Royal Court, and I've always dipped my toe in it. I think it's great workout for an actor, but, I'm very lucky in that, you know, there's film and TV for me. I've got lots of mates who are kind of just solely exist in the theatre world. And that is, I mean, it's just literally been decimated. And listen, I hope the vaccine programme works. I hope we get back to some sort of normality within live theatre soon, because it's the thing about theatre is, film, TV, theatre, radio, presenting, it's all, everything is connected, you know. And to not have that art form there is an absolute tragedy at the moment. And it's heartbreaking for so many people, not just the people on the stage, but the technicians behind the scenes, the playwrights, the directors, the producers of theatre. You know, when you think of institutions like the National Theatre or the Old Vic, you know, they're places of absolute power and force. And I think, you know, it's just a crying shame that this is the state of affairs at the moment.
When you say it's a good workout doing theatre, what do you mean by that?
You can get proper... Tim, there is literally no hiding on stage, is there? If I'm in front of a camera and I screw the lines up, we can shout cut and we go again. You know what I mean? It's like live theatre is a completely different ball game, but I absolutely adore it. To sit around the rehearsal table or in a rehearsal room for 5 weeks, meeting the actors, building up those relationships, working out what the beats are for the character and shaping the whole thing as a final piece. It's, you know, gearing up to that opening night. There's nothing more sort of intoxicating. If you're in a hit show, I mean, I've done some great shows in the past that I've been involved in. One that springs to mind is I did the show Mojo. It was the first revival of Mojo, Jez Butterworth's play in the West End. And I had Rupert Grint, Ben Whishaw, Colin Morgan. It was just an amazing company of actors to be in. And it was like being a rock star. Do you know what I mean? It was like the fans and everything. It was just crazy.
I was going to do a clumsy analogy and say, was it like playing in a football team? Were you captain? Were you spraying your lines around like you were Hoddle or Perlo?
yeah. I was the engine. I was the engine in that play. It didn't stop... The character was on amphetamines the whole night, and he didn't stop talking. But it's a great workout. I always say to young actors when they ask me for advice, I say, make sure you get your foot on the stage and go and do a play. Because not only is it, you know, a great workout for the actor and it nourishes you and you've got to sustain a character over, I don't know, 2.5 hours over a night, you know. And it's a great discipline, because every single time you get on the stage, the next night, the night after that, it's always wipe the slate clean. It's a new audience, come at it afresh. And it's a great showcase. I mean, I did 7 plays at the Royal Court when I started out. It was just, I was very lucky. I did Mike Lee and I did the Royal Court. Those two things were just such a wonderful thing for me to experience. And because the thing is, when you're on stage and you, and, you know, the reviews are great and it's alive and it's kicking, people come and watch. So you'll have a casting director or a producer there. And another great thing, we mentioned 1917. I'd never met Sam Mendes before that film. And it was obviously like a straight offer. And I was on there. They took me to Salisbury Plain and I was in my army outfit. And they said, obviously, listen, Sam wants you to go and he just wants to chat to you about the character before you start filming today. I said, of course. And obviously to meet you, Danny. And I was like, yeah, brilliant. So I went out to Sam's trailer. I knocked on the door and he let me in. And he was absolutely wonderful and welcoming. And he told me about the film and about, you know, the character I was playing and the inspiration behind it. But when he went, oh, and by the way, I thought you were really wonderful in that play at the Donmar. And you just suddenly, and I suddenly just went, wow, you know, wow. And you suddenly thought, wait, you've seen me in that? I didn't even know you were there. And you were great in the Red Line at the National. And I was like, okay. So it's just a great example of participating, of taking the risk and doing, if you're arming and ahhing about a project, do it. Because you just never know who's going to be in the audience, who's going to watch you on the screen, and you never know what's going to come of it.
Do you still have to sort of pinch yourself a bit in a way? Because I know what you're like. You're a nice, grounded guy. When you just get an offer for 1917, or you go to Sam Mendes' trailer and he goes, yeah, I watched you in that, I watched you in that. Is it a bit of like, geez, a little wake up going, wow, I've done so well for myself?
Yeah, you do have those pinch me moments without a doubt. And you know, when those moments happen, you've got to try and be cool, Danny, play it cool. I did Tintin years ago out in LA, which was obviously, this is going to be a name drop, directed by Spielberg. So it was like co-directed by Peter Jackson and Steven Spielberg. But it was like, again, this is another example of perseverance and keeping at it, is that the audition for Tintin came in with Gina Jay, the wonderful casting director. And I had to go to her office, which is down in St. Margaret's, I think it was, that way, Twickenham way. And I think I'd had a run of no's for self-tapes, and this thing came in for Tintin, and I just was like a bear with a sore head, and I went, I don't want to do this. And my wife, Lou dragged me down, my wife, and I just went, I was in such a bad mood in the car, and I went, this isn't going to happen. I'm never going to get this. Why are we bothering coming all the way over? And she says, no, you just never know. And I went in, did the self-tape, and then literally, I don't know, 3-4 days later, I was out in a park in Crouch End and the call came in saying, and this is the call, this is the message you want to get. Okay, Stephen loves your tape. And I was just like, so what? She said, yeah, it's between you and someone else. So it's a 50-50 chance. And lucky it came my way. Oh, so man. I very nearly went, Lou, stop the car, turn around. I just can't do another tape. So you just don't know.
Yeah. All right. Next question. Got a couple more to get through, a few more to get through. Tell our listeners something that's been life-changing for you.
I mean, I've mentioned seeing Michael Jackson. That was a bit of a light bulb moment.
What do you mean? What was that? What? Because you went, I want to be doing what he's doing. You want to be on the stage.
It was that thing of... It was exactly that. My mum had bought me like the cassette and the video of him. So I was about, what, 12, 13 years of age. So I was into him, but not to the point where, and I remember my mum saying, I'd never been to a concert before. I'd never been in a sort of sea of people like that. And I mean, when you're that young, to sort of see something on that scale, and I couldn't quite get my head around how all these people were here in this one place to see one person. And I was like, you know, he better be good, do you know what I mean? And then he sort of came out and was just like, it was the most electrifying, pulsating performance thing I'd ever seen. And I was just like, that's what I want to do. I mean, it was literally like that. And then, you know, I got myself in the bedroom and get the hat and the glove and all that sort of stuff, but so that was a light bulb moment. It was a life-changing moment, and I sort of couldn't look back after that.
I love that. It's really funny, isn't it, when you're younger and you see someone famous. I was talking to some people the other day. I said, who's the first famous person you saw? And I remember mine. I was driving and my parents had decided to take us up to the London, because I come from out in Middlesex way. And we were driving up and we were going past Regent's Park on that drag up towards Selfridges. And I looked to my left and there was a Rolls Royce, and in the back of it was Kenny Everett. And and I could not believe I'd seen Kenny Everett, because he was on TV doing with his big hands and everything at the time. And I was just like, and I remember just telling everyone for months, I'm better than everybody else because I've seen with my own eyes Kenny Everett. It meant so much. It was really bizarre.
Yeah. I mean, I still have moments where you get completely starstruck, where you end up going to when you were allowed to go to award ceremonies and things like that, and you know, all those sort of faces are in one location. You kind of do get. I'm trying to think of. I did meet. I was doing a play at the Royal Court, and one of the other actors in it, Richard Graham, his best friend was Daniel Day-Lewis, and which he told us in the rehearsals. And then I remember walking to the stage, coming from the dressing room onto the stage, and as we were coming down the flight of stairs, Richard said, oh yeah, by the way, my best mate's in tonight. And I went what but Daniel Day-Lewis? He said yeah he's in. And I was just like, and the thing about that play, there was no set, and you're actually told to look at the audience as they come in. So it was always a bit sort of avant-garde, and there was just a row of lights at the top and no set, just the actors. And the house lights were up, so you could see people taking their seats. And I was the lead in it, and I was like, oh man, don't look out. And I did, and he was literally right in the middle of the auditorium with a big fluorescent orange beanie on, huge beard, just there sitting there with his arms folded. And I was like, wow. And I met him afterwards. He was absolutely lovely. That was a big pinch me moment, because he's a sort of big hero of mine.
Oh, that's great. I'm going to move on to the next question then, which sort of ties in. What's it like to be famous?
Oh, I don't know, Tim. Sabre at the Wolseley or something. I don't ever think about it like that, really. I don't know if it's necessarily something that, you know, I just wanted to be a good actor, you know what I mean? And you can be aware of it though. Do you know what I mean? You must have that as well if you're out and about. And I think it's quite strange if I'm with my kids or something like that. And I think you develop this understanding that someone is over the other side of the room or the street really looking at you. You can just clock that.
Yeah.
Don't
you ever find though you forget, and then suddenly you realize people were, you're doing something a bit stupid or something, or you're, and then you go, oh god, that person's recognized me, and I'm like, what have I done? What am I doing?
And you have road rage in your car isn't advised if you're famous. Do you know what I mean? Particularly with camera phones, I find all that stuff. Yeah, you know, we're spied on all the time now, aren't you? So it's always very, very, very tricky.
All right. When was the happiest you've ever felt?
Lou and I, we've been together about 15 years, but we decided to get married, I think it was about 3 years ago, actually. So it was relatively recently. And we were always, that was never our concern. It was never really on the cards to get married. And then we decided to do it. I mean, obviously, they're always stressful things to plan, aren't they? But I have to say, I mean, it's an absolute cliche, but it was the happiest day of my life. It was a wonderful day of celebration. What you have to, you know, when you get married, all of those people are congregated in that room for the union of two people. And it was just a great day. It was fantastic.
That's good. And that leads me really nicely onto the next question. What's the key to a good relationship, or good relationships? It could be with other, with work, people, or or wife?
She probably, good job she's not in the room. No, I don't know. I mean, Tim, it's about listening, isn't it, really? It's about trying to, what is it about? I think it's about accepting that, I think it's accepting the good and the bad in your partner, isn't it? It's about taking the rough with the smooth. Do you know what I mean? And I think if people can forgive your failures in life and, you know, you hold on to that love you have for one another. And that, I mean, you know, it's a tricky thing sometimes, isn't it? I mean, all relationships go through ups and downs. It's never going to be plain sailing. But I think you obviously get to a point where you have such companionship with one another, and especially you've got kids and things like that. I just think you just got to listen to one another, and it's not always about you, Danny. That's what it is.
Oh, yeah. How does it work with acting? So you get put together with another actor, because I've heard rumors about people stealing scenes and stuff like that. How quickly do you have to form that bond? I mean, maybe it's different in theatre to film or TV, but how quickly is it you have to, and how quickly?
It's an odd one, Tim, because, you know, actresses that I've worked with, if you've got to be in love with someone, it's a very pressurised and sort of, it's not a normal state of affairs, really, because if you're playing like lovers, for example, you know, that union and that and we're talking about chemistry. If that chemistry doesn't work, the sort of show is going to be flat on its ass. So you have to convince yourself that you're the right pairing, and somehow you've got to have that chemistry and make it spark with one another. But it's you know, I'd like to think that I'm a very sort of generous actor. Do you know what I mean? But I mean, there's been some actors you work with that you don't particularly get on with, and that can be quite tricky because you've got to act that, you know, you've got to act that you like one another. But it's, you know, that's your job, isn't it? You just got to convince the audience that you are in that union with that person, and then it actually works.
So when you get to Code 404 with Stephen Graham, he's what a great actor he is. You're a great actor, he's a great actor. And then you're both, let's do a comedy role. It's funny because I sat down to watch it thinking, what's this going to be like? By the way, I love it. I love both of you, but it's really good. And I'm not just saying that. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was funny, the comedy here. I loved it. Was it exciting when you get, because you knew him already, didn't you? And then you got paired up to do that together.
Oh, yeah. Steve and I, weirdly, years ago, we worked on a show called Top Buzzer, which was a Johnny Vaughan and Ed Allen comedy. That was the show that I met my wife on. Lou was the makeup artist. And Stephen actually got us together. He's our Cilla Black. That's what I always say to him. But I say, it's all your fault, Steve. No, we got on like a house on fire back then. I became busy. He was busy. And then Code 404 just sort of landed on my lap, and they wanted me to attach myself to it. And then I read it and I was like, because it's a classic funny man, straight man, double act, you know, which has always been throughout the world of comedy throughout the years. And I thought, who could play that? And I met the exec and I said, listen, have you cast anyone? They were like, no. I said, look, what about Stephen Graham? Because we've always tried to find something together. And he's I remember his eyes just lit up. I mean, who wouldn't when you say that name? So it was like, if you can get him. And I said, look, let me send it to him. And I think he just needed a bit of a departure from all the heavy roles that he'd been doing, as I'd with me. So it just seemed to click, really. And I mean, I did an ADR session the other day for the second series, and they showed me.
What does ADR mean?
It means, everyone always asks, it's like automated dialogue recording or something like that. Right. It's that thing of like, if it was noisy on that day and you didn't get the line clean on the mic, you've got to come in and do it again. But they showed me a lot of a lot of the scenes. And I mean, as soon as I read Code 404, it just made me roar with laughter, because that's my sense of humour. It's very slapstick. it's very silly. There's lots of physical comedy in it, and I love all that. And but even with this second series, and it seems to be because we'd had 7 months out of work in the lockdown. And then I remember just before we started filming the second series, Steve phoned me and he went, "Can I just talk to you about something?" And I was like, "Yeah." He said, "I'm really nervous. I haven't done anything for 7 months." I said, "No." I said, "Are you feeling what I'm feeling? It's like, this feels like our first ever job again. Because if you haven't done it for 7 months, you're a bit ring rusty." And then all of a sudden we were there on set on day one. Everyone's in masks. It's all COVID. It's all very different. And we're finding our feet with it. But having watched, and then after a few days, we were flying. And having watched the scenes back, you can really see the performances that we relish it. You know, I think it's a group of actors up there that we're back doing what we love. And I think it's really made it a much better second series.
Yeah, but you say it's silly in a way. A lot of physical acting, you're right. But I think it's smart. And I like it because it sometimes leaves the jokes for you to fill in the ends. And I like that. I always like comedy where you don't actually tell me everything. I've got to fill in the gaps a bit. And that's where the laugh is coming. I thoroughly enjoy it. It must be great that it's got returning. It's a returning series.
Yeah, I mean, and they're all in there again. Adam Maxwell Martin and Rosie Cavalier. And I just think for me, it was just when my agent phoned and said, "Look, they want you to play a copper who gets killed at the beginning." And I was like, we've sort of been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. And what are you talking about? She went, "No, darling, you come back part AI." And I was just like, so that premise of a hotshot copper with the best arrest rate who comes back and the wiring's all wrong and he's completely crap. That is just, to me, that's just a very funny premise, you know. But you've got a lot of pathos in there as well. There's lots of good acting in there, and it's just an absolute joy to make. And having also seen the outtake reel for the second series, that's just as good as the actual show itself. Because we literally don't stop having a laugh. It's very funny.
Okay, couple more questions. And I love it because when I'm talking to you about movies, films, acting, anything like that, you love it. You come alive. When I talk to you about the other stuff, you're all right, but you prefer talking about acting. I can tell it's a passion. So this is way away from this, but this is always my favorite question is, have you seen a ghost or a UFO?
Do you know what, Tim? I've never, ever experienced anything like that at all. I've never... I've spoken to people that have seen things, and but honestly, I've never had a moment where I mean, the closest to anything like that, where you think someone's standing at the end of your bed, but it's, you realise you're still in a dream or something. But no, have you ever seen anything like that?
No, that's why I ask the question all the time, because I really want to believe in UFOs. I really want to believe they're already here. The aliens are walking amongst us, and the extraterrestrials are up there somewhere, and UFOs are actually alien spaceships. So I really want to believe it so badly, and I spend a lot of time online looking at it all. I'm obsessed with it. I love it.
Oh really? Right.
I've found no evidence yet, and I really want to believe in ghosts as well, and I've never seen one of those. I think it's unfair that I haven't. I really got into time travelers for a while, which I spent time looking online and looking at time travelers. If you go down that rabbit hole, it's endless amounts. But there's all these guys I was just gonna say, there's all these guys out there who say they're time travelers, and the thing is, it doesn't take a lot. I mean, it's like your profession, it doesn't take a lot before I'm going, yeah, I believe them. Tell me, I believe them.
When you talk about things like, what is it in America, Area 51?
Yeah.
That stuff is very interesting, isn't it? I mean, you suddenly think, okay, why is it top secret? What's going on there? They're obviously doing, well, they could be doing, high-tech military exercises and things like that. But, the conspiracies of this world are something that really fascinates me. I mean, I watched the other night was JFK, the assassination of Kennedy, and I'm like, the Oliver Stone movie, all of the stuff that's gone into that. I mean, those FBI files are still under lock and key, aren't they? And I think, I don't know when they're going to be released or will they ever be released, But you have to question, was it the government that did that? Was it the mafia? Was it the Soviets? You just don't know. All of those, I mean, I'm sort of into conspiracy theories and stuff.
Yeah.
That fascinates me.
There was a, there's a guy talking, going back to UFOs, there's a guy who's been doing the rounds recently. I don't know why. He was on Joe Rogan's podcast, actually, and he was discussing how he got abducted years ago. And there's a film about him. I can't remember the name of the film now, which is a big film. And he was saying there's lots of inaccuracies. But basically, yeah. seven guys went out into the woods. They see a UFO. This one guy runs towards it. He gets sucked up into the UFO. All the other guys go back to the village or town where they're working. And they said, look, he's been abducted. Everyone's going, you're a lunatic. So they said, we saw a UFO, right? The guy disappears for 3 days, then comes wandering back in. And he talks about how he's abducted and he saw the aliens and everything else and blah, 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 blah. And they made a film on it, but everyone's stuck with their story. All these guys have stuck with their story that he got abducted. They all, everyone in the village or town thought that the seven guys had murdered him, but they hadn't. And then there was other people in the vicinity who said they saw the lights as well. So I just take in all that information and I believe they're here.
What's the name of that movie? I've got to check that out.
Oh, do you know what? I can't remember the name of the film. God, it's really bugging me. I can't remember now, but the film, he says there's lots of inaccuracies in the film. Once I remember it, I'll text you or something. But all right. Thanks so much. Final question, Danny, is what is the meaning of life?
What would I say? Listen, I think it's to be, to love and to be loved, isn't it? And to find happiness on that front, really. I mean, I think, you mentioned that I come alive, but I'm talking about acting. I think that's all good, but you know, a successful acting career won't keep you warm in bed at night, isn't it? So it's about to love and to be loved and to cherish your family and to look after them, really. I think that's, when it all boils down to that, that's the only thing that's important.
I wasn't saying that you come alive and acting in a bad way. I was just saying it's amazing watching you because your love for your industry is you can see it. You can see it in your, when I ask you the questions, your eyes light up. You love talking about it, because I mean, it's just you fall in love with acting, haven't you, in that world? And
yeah, I feel lucky that I've found a that I enjoy doing. You know, I feel blessed with that. It's a real, listen, I think what I do as a job is an utter privilege, really, and I just don't take it for granted.
Well, mate, you're absolutely brilliant at it. What's the next thing you've got coming out? What can people see you on?
Well, I think Code 404, I think we're talking about maybe April or May that's going to come out. Temple, we've completed filming, and I think that might be in the autumn as well. So the Danny Mays juggernaut will suddenly slow down because of lockdown, but we'll see what else is out there, you know.
And if people want to follow you on Twitter to find out the rest, what's your handle there again?
It's Daniel Mays 9. I think that's the same on Instagram as well. I'm sort of more on, I think the Twitter thing is, it's more about Instagram now. I don't know. It seems like a nicer place to be.
It does.
It's just picture-led, isn't it?
Yeah, and you don't get as many trolls being abusive to you, and you can delete them once they are, so it's good. So
yeah. I think that's where you'll be finding me much more on there.
Danny, fantastic to speak to you. Thank you so much for doing this.
And you, Tim. Nice to see you as always, mate. Take it easy.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quokka. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.